So hi, Radhika. Thank you for joining the Blind Ambition podcast. The Blind Ambition provides a candid look into some of the top companies and doers in the tech industry. And I'm excited that you're here as you're a principal at Dell Technologies Capital. And for those who don't know, Dell Technologies Capital leads investments in disruptive early stage startups in enterprise and cloud infrastructure. Radhika's investments focus on enterprise and cloud infrastructure, AI and machine learning, data, and deep tech. And before Dell Capital, Radhika was an investment director at Samsung Catalyst Fund, and notably, her background is in engineering and product management.
Thank you for having me, Rick. Great to be here.
So I have to start. What is it like to work at Dell Technologies Capital and a venture capital firm?
It's actually really fun. I've been at Dell Tech Capital about 10 months now. So I joined at the middle of last year. And then before that, I've been investing for about 4 years before that. I was at Samsung, as you mentioned, for a few years. And venture capital is a fun job. You know, I think like most people in venture, I didn't have a linear path into it. You sort of meander your way a little bit, and then you just find yourself usually in a VC job. There's no straight path. But I think what I really like about it, I think if you're intellectually curious, I feel like I'm always drinking from the fire hose. You're always meeting really smart people who are really building the future of technology and business, and you get to work with all of these smart, hardworking, good people and get to learn from them every day, get to work with them every day. And that's what's really fun for me in this job.
What are some of the hot areas and the fast growing areas that you see in your line of work?
Yeah, we are thinking about the future of the enterprise, right? So when you think about the future of the enterprise, which is how will people 5-10 years down the line, how will people communicate? How will organizations do work? How will people collaborate? And we are also, the approach we're taking is, what are the underlying infrastructures that have to power those new experiences in people working together and collaborating in a better way? And on the infrastructure side, everything that we hear about from new types of data infrastructure, you know, we're recording this over Zoom, sitting many miles away. There is a lot of infrastructure that's powering that. You know, there's the cloud where the software is probably running. There's a lot of connectivity in the middle with, you know, now Wi-Fi, 4G, but also 5G probably coming soon. A lot of deployments happening there. And everything from the semiconductors that power it all the way to all of the other layers of the infrastructure that have to power the new ways for us to work and collaborate. And that's what we're thinking about, and that's what we're excited about, the underlying technologies to power all of that.
I mean, Jack, I don't know about you, but I am so happy with most technology that it just works and I don't ask questions, right?
Yeah.
But you don't have that luxury. You have to dive deep into what these companies are doing, their technology, their stack, their teams. What does that process look like? How complex can these things get?
It's incredibly fun, I will tell you. Again, as I said, one of the most exciting parts about the job is you're really talking to people who are building the future as we speak. And I think, you know, when you see something that's really at the cutting edge, you see things on the surface and then you dive deep in, and that's where you get, and for the right kinds of companies, you get more and more excited the more you go deep dive and go dive in to see what the potential of this technology could really be in terms of where it is now and where it could be, where it could take the world 5 years from today. And you know, it's actually a really fun process to go peel the onions across all of that.
That has to be amazing. So you're kind of looking at the future. What do you see from here to the next 3 to 5 years? Like, what are some examples that would just make, you know, the people watching to say, wow, I can't believe that's going to be coming down the road and change our lives?
Yeah, I think, you know, there's all of the buzzwords that we talk about today and that we've been talking about from the last couple of years. Like we talk a lot about AI and machine learning. I don't see it from the perspective of a singularity hitting and, you know, machines getting smarter than humans, but there's a lot of places where machine learning is already creating an impact in terms of just driving a lot of cost savings, making us more productive, helping humans do better in terms of the tasks that they do. We look at connectivity, like, you know, robotics connected factories. If you go into some of these warehouses, there's a lot of machines, a lot more machines floating around now than human beings floating around. I think that's going to continue. And, you know, the other things, there's a lot of new technologies, maybe not 2 or 3 years down the horizon, but 5 or 10 years down the horizon. I think quantum computing is going to get real. And that's going to have a tremendous impact on how we compute and how we do things. Think about how the semiconductors changed the world, how the internet changed the world. I think that's another underlying technology that's going to have a huge impact. And people from the outside, I think it's not talked about enough, but I think it's closer than people think.
Wow. Wait, just to unpack it, Rick, I don't know if you're with me on this, but she casually said so many things that seem huge. So let's just take the first one with quantum computing for people who are not familiar with it, because of course Rick and I know it very well, but for other people who aren't familiar, what should they know about? What does that mean and how would that change things?
Yeah, it's at the intersection of physics and computer science, right? Right now at the core of our computing is the transistor, and the transistor has two states, it's on and off. So that's what you call a bit. With a quantum system now, you actually have not just two states, there's multiple states that you can encode, but with the help of complex physics, you can actually now start doing computing across those many different states, which meant that many problems that are really hard for traditional computers to do, you can actually do with these new types of systems. I don't think it's here today. I think it's 5 or 10 years down the line, for example, but there's going to be a lot more that we'll be able to do with our computers and be able to do it a lot faster. That it's going to be a paradigm shift, I think.
And you said this is just 5 years away?
Or I would say at the least 5, you know, there's, but, you know, yeah, at the least 5, but I think it's closer than people think.
I mean, when you're hearing and working with such cutting edge technologies, how do you kind of figure out, oh, like I could see this happening versus, oh, perhaps this is just hype? What does your thought process look like there?
I think the number one thing that we index on with the startups we meet with is, of course, the team, right? It's the team that's building it. You want to have people who have very strong credibility in the areas where they're operating. As investors in these cutting edge technologies, we look for people who have expertise in those technologies and have built something that's deeply technically differentiated. And to couple with that, you don't just want technology, you want technology that can be built into a product and the product that can be built into a business. So you're also trying to understand what can this technology be used for. How will it add value to consumers and enterprises? And then is this the team that can help build a business around it and capture that value to make it into a sustainable business that's growing at a venture scale as well? So starts with the team, goes into, you know, is this something that people will want to use and buy? And is this a scalable business from that can continue going on?
Radhika, to go back to when you said about when you look at factories, you see more robots than people. You hear a debate where some will say, hey, robotics, machine learning, AI will take away jobs. But then you hear others say, well, there'll be new jobs created. You're really in the center of this. How do you see this playing out?
I envision a collaborative world. Mm-hmm. I envision one where we as humans, we do things that we do best, which is higher order thinking, analysis, communications, storytelling, working with people, and then everything that's manual, that's repetitive, that requires brute force calculation, I think we offload that to automation. And that can be physical automation, like robots in factories, where it's a lot of taking things and putting them into bins and picking them and putting them into boxes. You want robots to do that. And the same thing with knowledge workers. If there's a lot of data entry, I don't want to be doing that data entry. I want to be doing the higher order thinking. And I think that's where the world is moving towards. And that's where the future I envision, which is extremely collaborative with humans at the center, but then everything to augment us around that, to make us more productive, to make us do more meaningful, engaging, and productive work.
Given that scenario, do you think, because I've been speaking to a lot of folks and writing these articles for Forbes, where they're saying there's a big gap between what tech companies need in terms of the skill sets and what's available. And there's a lot of boot camps, a lot of upskilling. Do you feel that somehow, whether it's a government and business collaboration, just to get people to learn new skills, otherwise they'll get left behind in this kind of new world that we're talking about?
Yeah, I think if you look at just the demand for software engineers, developers, data scientists, in the light of digital transformation, in the light of the skills that organizations require, you're absolutely spot on. The demand has skyrocketed. The supply side has caught up, and some of the things that you mentioned in terms of upskill programs and boot camps, some of that has helped, but the delta is still fairly prevalent. The delta is still there, and I think that will still continue. So things to help that delta, I think, we continue to increase the pipeline. The nice thing is, if you look at the number of CS grads coming out, that is increasing, but that's not increasing at the pace that we needed to increase. So it does have to be a continuation of an investment in companies investing in their workers, helping upskill them, helping them think about where the future is going 5, 7, 10 years down, and helping them get to that skill set. It's about universities also working closely with business in equipping the next generation of grads with these skills. And then all of the things that come in conjunction, all of the support system that come in conjunction with people, with helping people get to those new jobs and upskill continuously. It's a continuous process. You can't just say, I'm going to do it now and then leave it for the next few years and we're set. It has to be a continuous process, both as an individual, if you want to be competitive in today's world, and as an organization. Hiring and retaining talent is the number one source of competitive advantage for you. So for you to invest in those people and invest in making sure they're the right skill set and they continue to evolve, I think that's going to be pretty key for individuals, businesses, and society as a whole, for sure.
I mean, given what you mentioned about such a huge demand needed for job training, skill training, are you making any investments like applying deep tech, AI data into talent or workforce management or professional development, these type of skills or industries?
We haven't made any specific investments in these. We've been watching it closely in terms of the new types of technologies to help, you know, identify the right people for a role and targeting them and matching them with that. Where we have made investments is really helping people do the jobs that they're good at, and then, you know, again, automating the rest. And I mentioned previously, so we've invested in a warehouse robotics company, for example. And then recently I made an investment in a company that helps people interface with their systems so that the humans are the ones that are doing the higher level order work. And then there's ways for them to interact with the automation in a way that fits their workflow. So, you know, I can go into a Slack channel and just how I would talk to a teammate, they can talk to a conversational bot and tell and offload the repetitive manual tasks to them versus having to do that task, which I'm spending maybe 60% of my day on today, unfortunately. But we have made investments on that side of the house quite a bit.
Wait, so you would talk into like a Slack channel that would go to some robotic and then they would do the task?
Yeah, you know, simple things like, hey, update my deal, close my deal. So as part of closing a deal, you have to go into, say, Salesforce, you have to go in and update a record. You may have to send out, fire out 5 different emails to 5 different people saying, here's what, here's a deal that I've closed. Can you update all of these other systems? There might be some supplemental documentation that you have to do in order to get that deal closed, and you know, certain forms that you may have to sign. So human may be generating those forms, but if that can happen automatically by me triggering that action, then there's a lot of things that are offloaded and I can go and focus on just closing that sale.
Wait, is this something that already exists or is that something that you're working towards?
Yeah, this exists. It doesn't work in 100% of the cases. I think, again, you know, if you say, is there a perfect AI system that can understand 100% what you and I are talking about? Definitely not.
Okay.
But can we constrain the problem so that it works well for these 3, 4, 5 use cases really well and helps me do those tasks, again, operating in that constrained environment, then AI is okay. And that's the same with physical robots as well, right? If you say, hey, can a car go in and drive in the roads of San Francisco with all of the edge cases around it? Definitely not. But if you create a rig in a factory that is a lot more structured and, you know, the robot has a map around it and can go around it and navigate its things around, yeah, technology is there to do that.
Rick, you're processing it. I can see you're you're taking it all in. It's like looking at you. Like the potential of how this could all play out, right?
No, that's exactly it. And, you know, like I'm always so impressed by what I read within the blind community. There are so many software engineers, technologists that have these side projects or code in their spare time. Do you have any advice? Because some of them have ideas, well, not quite this, but quite near in terms of just being original. And so I wonder, do you have any advice, especially as a former software engineer yourself, when is the moment where you can take your kind of side project into a product or a business or even a startup? What does that kind of process or timeline even look like?
Yeah, I think there's, it's a journey, right? For sure. I think you build an interesting technology, you have to have a lot of different conversations with potential users, with potential customers, to see what would people use that technology for. And that's what takes it from a technology into a product. Now, product to startup, that's really for you to figure out. The moment is, am I willing to be all in on this? Am I willing to take the plunge? A side hustle is not a startup. So am I willing to take the plunge? Am I willing to dedicate the next 5, 7, 10 plus years of my life into this? Can I recruit people to do this with me? Because I will, of course, it takes a village. So can I recruit the first couple of team members? Can I find investors who can believe in my vision and work with me in this journey? And again, when you have that conviction that, yes, I can build something of value, and then the demand is big enough and I have the team to execute on that demand to have this grow and be a real business and a venture scale business, I think that's the journey that you have to go. You know, timeline, it could be anywhere from a few months to years in some cases when you're answering these questions and seeing, is the timing right for me to take the plunge also?
I mean, digging into kind of that aspect of founding, what if it's just, you know, me with a great idea? how do I recruit others? Let's say I might not have a great social network, right? And certainly like not even thinking about funding, but just having a team to build something off the ground. How would you recommend that someone approach that situation?
Yeah, usually it comes from people you work with, people you've gone to school with, people who may not be first degree connections, but second degree connections. And that's where, you being able to articulate the vision of what you're building and get people to buy into that vision, that goes a long way. And, storytelling and selling, that's in every aspect of you building a startup, whether it's in recruiting, as we talked about, whether it's pitching to investors, whether it's pitching to customers. And as you have more of these conversations, that's where you get better and better at it. It's a skill that you can learn and cultivate over time. And to find the people who would go on that journey with you, I think it's building those relationships, talking to a lot of people, and investing that time as well. Often it may take, a decent period of time for people to understand your vision and be ready to embark on that vision with you. Because as I said, it's going to be a long-term journey with its own set of ups and downs, and you need to be ready for those ups and downs, and the people who are going to be joining you, they need to be ready for that as well.
So it sounds like the best way to get started is to get started, and you have to build from somewhere.
Exactly. Get started, leverage your trusted networks, expand those trusted networks. Absolutely.
Do you ever get nervous, or what would you say to someone that's nervous about doing the storytelling and talking to second, third degree connections? And what if someone steals my fantastic idea?
I think that just means it's a huge market, and you validated the demand for this thing. I think that's a very secondary concern. I don't think people should be worried about that. I think it's really, as you said, getting over that initial nervousness and letting yourself be out there. I think especially as engineers, we're not used to doing that day in, day out, and getting outside our comfort zone and putting ourselves out there and being vulnerable and starting to have these learning cycles and have these accelerated learning cycles. All of these skills, storytelling that you talked about, these are skills you can learn and you can improve and get better over time. Not something to be intimidated by. Find people who can help you, find people who can compliment you, and it's going to be it's all going to be about how quickly you can do these learning cycles and iterate on yourself and as an individual, and then the product and company as you build it as well.
I want to dig into what you said about comfort level, right? Because a lot of technologists, software engineers, they work at some of the most fabulous companies, right? They mm-hmm. have a lot of perks, good pay, they have structures and processes and teams that yep. can support them. It's almost like going from everything to, square one again, right? Many cases, that is exactly the case. Is there a certain stage of life that you might have to be in, or a state of mind where you can make that jump, or is it something else entirely?
I don't think there's a stage of life, to be honest. I think it's certainly, you need to be ready for it. And I will be honest, it doesn't work for everybody, right? A lot of people, they like the structure, they like the processes. And clearly it works well for these big companies, right? There's a reason why they've instated these processes in the first place, because to operate at that scale, you need to have, you need to be able to manage people and processes at that scale. I'll share with you my story around why I got excited about startups. When I was a young computer science graduate, many of these large tech companies, they try to bring you in by saying, hey, every line of code you write or every product you build is going to impact hundreds of millions of users. And as you spend time in these companies, you just learn to take that with a grain of salt, because these are such massive organizations. At least for me, I was working on a feature within a feature within a feature. They were fantastic learning opportunities. I worked with some of the smartest people, but where I felt limited was the impact that I wanted to have and the learning that I wanted from the job that I did. And so, you know, for me, the objective was to maximize learning and impact. And it turned out the startup world is fantastic for that. Execution speed is the bread and butter for startups. And really every line of code you write has to go into production the next day, because that's what's important for survival. And I exaggerate a little bit, but you know, it's true. And the level of impact that you can have at a startup, that's unprecedented, because again, there's too much to do, not enough people to do it. And it is a mindset shift. I will be honest, you know, if you've been at a large company and you've been comfortable, it does take you out of that comfort zone. But there are individuals who thrive outside of that comfort zone and thrive in that unstructured environment. It can take a while to get used to, but if you can get used to that ambiguity, the rewards, the risk is there, but the rewards are also potentially enormous.
Can I ask you, on the other side of the spectrum, from the startup to, we've seen so many unicorn companies now. What I truly don't understand is that you'll have companies, not only the recent ones during the pandemic, but if you go to the Ubers and others of the world, where they're just burning through cash and not making profits. How, I'm really confused. And I think a lot of people are, how do you sustain that model where other companies, you know, you have to have a profit and you have to earn, you know, money, where they're not? How does that kind of keep working that way?
At some point it doesn't. And at some point, which I think some of these companies are at that point now, where you have to stop a little bit and think about not just growth, but also profitability and cash flow. And I think we're seeing that in the market today, where the companies that have the growth and profitability, they are the ones that are being rewarded. And the companies that are just showing growth, they are being penalized a little bit now. So I think at some point the pendulum shifts. And yeah. I think for individuals who are working at these companies in that hyper growth stage, it can still be a fantastic opportunity to grow in and learn and see how do you scale a platform to that level. And then you know, once that point hits where you have to start focusing a lot more on the business discipline, then there are levers that you have to now actively think about switching. And I think many of these companies are at that stage right now where they're trying to figure out what levers do they realistically have to not just do the massive growths that they've had in the past, but also do it with the right fundamentals in the business and the unit economics and profitability and metrics that they have to now show to the investors.
Especially, do you think it's takes front and center now with the sell-off in the, you know, correction, bear market in some sectors? The NASDAQ generally has been hit hard. So these tech companies hit hard. Is that kind of a wake-up call where, let's say you are a VC for some of these larger entities, you start saying to the CEO, execs, hey guys, when are you gonna get, we gotta get some profits here, otherwise things could get scary. Do you think we're at that point with a lot of companies that don't have the profits and there's inflation, you know, interest rates are going higher and maybe a little fear watching all these stocks fall off?
Yeah, again, you know, it's a little bit different for us in the world of enterprise as well, where it's not always just about a land grab that you're trying to do, which is somewhat of a dynamic in some of these industries. But yeah, you're absolutely right. I think when you do have cycles that you're going through, you do want to stress to your companies that, you know, focus on the fundamentals, make sure that you're getting the growth that you need to show that this is continuing to accelerate at the pace you need it to accelerate, but also focusing on the fundamentals of the business, make sure the unit economics works out and, you know, the metrics, the key metrics for your business are in line with how you expect to grow as you grow. But again, you know, a little bit different in the world of more traditional enterprise than these large-scale consumer companies.
Got
It makes a lot of sense.
And I'm so curious, are there any other kind of things that you wish people understood about kind of that difference between enterprise and kind of what most folks might think of when they think about startup and they think consumer, they think, you know, some kind of fun app?
I think when you think about the enterprise side, it's a lot more thinking about, you know, software as a business and how do you, who identifying who is your target customer, building out a sales team in selling to those customers, being close to them, understanding the value that your product is creating for them, and doing that day in and day out repeatably and at scale. That is definitely a different mindset than you building a consumer app where you're trying to get a critical mass of users and continuing that hockey stick growth in terms of users. So it's definitely a different motion of selling technology and software as a business versus in the consumer world.
I mean, you mentioned something interesting about scale. So if I am someone that wants to, you know, start my own enterprise-focused startup, do I necessarily have to focus on solving a big problem to do well in enterprise? Or are there, you know, simpler or very niche things that I can get into to have a meaningful enterprise business?
You can build a business. It just may not be a venture scale startup, right? For it to make sense for investors to come in and make money in venture capital as an asset class with every investment, you know, typically depending on the stage where investors coming in, they're thinking about how does my investment become 5, 10x at the least, right? So if it's a niche product that users love, you can certainly build a big business out of it. Would it be a $1 billion company? Maybe, maybe not. So if you want to take venture capital investment, there are certain, it does have to be a big problem to answer your question. It has to be a big market and your product does need to be differentiated enough so that you can capture a big part, a meaningful part of that, that large market that's hopefully growing as well. So certainly can build a business out of it. Now, can it be a $1 billion business? That's the question you want to answer in terms of that.
Is there anything else you wish people knew or understood about venture capital?
Yeah, I think the big thing is, you know, it's not just capital. Yes, capital is table stakes. You are looking for money to get gas to accelerate growth and in terms of what you're building, but there's many other things that hopefully VCs are doing for you. You know, firstly, hopefully your investors are providing you with the leverage in terms of the customer introductions you need, particularly important in an enterprise world. They're hopefully getting you introductions to the people that you need to help build your team. They're definitely not building the business for you, but helping you, helping open the right doors for you. Being thought partners, again, you know, it's 5, 7, 10 plus year long journey. You want people that you trust who have the same values as you, who will help you in this journey, really be partners as you think about big strategic decisions that you're making in this journey along the ride of building the product and the business. And hopefully are people who are fairly experienced and knowledgeable about the space you're in as well. You know, you just, again, don't want people to just give you money and leave. It's it takes a village to build a successful startup, to build a successful company, and you want the right people in that camp with you as you start to build this thing.
Outside of where you are now, put aside Dell, looking in the Valley as a whole, do you see kind of really cool things out there that people are working on? And if you don't want to name the companies, whatever, just because it's interesting to see in the future, as you talked about at the beginning of the conversation, anything that you see that like really cool innovation, platforms, apps that you hear are in the works that we would say, oh my goodness, I can't wait for that. This is fantastic.
You know, I read about something today morning where a biotech startup has raised money to bring back the woolly mammoth that is an extinct species.
Okay, there you go. You
exactly. Delivered. Exactly.
Rick, did you see that coming? That was, I did not see that one.
Yeah, Boston-based startup, pioneers of biotech. This professor named George Church, you know, I don't know much about biology, but I dabble in it. And today morning, I heard that they got $60 million to use gene editing techniques that are fairly cutting edge to bring back extinct species. I think that's pretty freaking amazing.
Wow. Well, now, is it going to be like Jurassic Park?
I hope not. I hope not. Bring it back.
Good news is we can bring back the woolly mammoth. Bad news is we have a bunch of Tyrannosaurus Rexes and oh my goodness. So that's interesting. Wow. And yeah. Anything else that's on your radar that you feel, wow, this is mind blowing?
I think, you know, in terms of, again, the areas we look at, we're seeing a lot of people interacting in different types of ways. You know, you talk about AR, VR hasn't really caught on yet, but we've spent the last 2 years just staring into screens and working with people in screens. I think there still has to be a better way in how you interact with people. And I think we'll see some more interesting innovation in some of those multimodal interactive capabilities. Again, it's a little bit further down the horizon as those come into play and how they become mainstream in organizations and how we do work. But I look forward to that as well.
Yeah, have you seen like, this gentleman, I can't recall his name, I think Andrew Kegel, who invested $2.5 million into Decentraland and building a fashion show. And I don't know if you've seen it, but it's beautiful. Like when you look at in virtual reality, it looks like this beautiful malls and beautiful stores and beautiful buildings, and they're renting out places. And it's really interesting.
Yep. I haven't bought land or partaken in that, but you know, there's certainly a lot of interesting stuff that's going on in that world as well.
I mean, so I think it begs the obvious question, like, do you imagine that one day we will be talking to each other and working in the so-called metaverse?
I think depends on how you define it. You know, when we think about metaverse, we think of it as anywhere the physical and digital are intersecting. And you can argue we're in the metaverse right now, talking to each other in the metaverse, right? Like this would not have been possible a few years ago. So I don't see us putting on glasses, and at least not in the form factor they are today, and spending, you know, 12 plus hours of our day doing that. I think the modality has to improve substantially, but I do see much richer forms of interaction. I think haptics are going to improve. So how you interact with devices is going to continue to improve. I think the modalities of how you connect with people and communicate with people and not just spend 6 hours a day on your phones, I think that's going to improve. And I do look forward to those harnessing technology for like more meaningful and richer interactions than the way we have them today.
Got it. And I want to end on one last note, and I hope you don't mind me going to this background, but you came from a software engineer, computer science degree background, and now you are working as a venture capitalist talking about quantum computing, robots in factories. How did you make that jump from operator to financial investor?
Yeah, I think I mentioned how I ended up in startups. And I think in startups, the classic, the double-edged sword is there's too much to do, not enough people to do it. And so even though I was doing engineering and product at those startups, I got pulled into a lot of different threads within the companies, whether it was sales or marketing, customer success. And over time, I just realized I was spending a lot less time doing core engineering than I was doing product building, selling, and all of the other functions that you have to do in building products and building a business. So I reached a personal inflection point myself where it was, hey, I joined as an engineer, but I'm doing a lot less and honing my craft a lot less than I should really be doing. And I'm really excited about these other facets of running the business and building products. And that was my personal inflection point, which is what led me to my next step, which was business school. And business school, I think the biggest advantage is really the perspectives you get and the people and opportunities you're exposed to, which you may not normally get to do as part of your day-to-day job. And that was really the point for me where I got exposed to venture as a career as well. Because before that, it was really, hey, I work at a startup and these are people who give money so that we can continue to do what we want to do. These are people who come to our office every 6 to 8 weeks for board meetings and we help prepare board decks and they get an update on the business, but not really exposed to venture as a career. But it was during business school where I was exploring, hey, what are other careers within the technology world? Whether it's anything tangential to product, strategy, anything else. And venture just kept coming up as a place to explore if you really liked startups and liked working with startups, but didn't necessarily want to be at a startup building that out. And it was something worth exploring. And as I delved deeper into it, I just was really fascinated by it. And as I spent time in it, I was really excited by the work that I was doing. Again, as I mentioned to you, you're working with a lot of different startups. You're getting to meet people who are building these startups. So you get to be pretty close to the startup world. I get to leverage my former technical background to both, delve deeper into technologies, understand how people are building certain things, where might they be differentiated, and also then being able to take a step back and think about, hey, can this be a big, meaningful, high growth business around this technology and product? And that's, I think, what's really kept me in the job that I've been here a few years. So long-winded journey, but happy where I ended up.
That's it for The Blind Ambition. If you enjoyed the show, please leave us a 5-star rating and a review. And don't forget to subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. Thanks for listening.